Welcome to this special eight-show series on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. What are you eating, and why should you care? Throughout this broadcast, Mrs. Green examines how true preservation of the planet starts with your fork. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thank you so much for joining us today for the fourth of our eighth special series on healthy eating. What am I eating and why should I care? It all starts with your fork. And I cannot believe that this is the fourth show. We greatly appreciate the support of our sponsors to make shows like this possible. And a special thanks today to the sponsor of this show, the Fairfax Companies. If you're listening, you know we love you. We love that you're dedicated to improving the environment through creative and innovative management practices, because you are, and we're proud to have you as our partner. So proud I am to have as my return guest today for this fourth in the series of podcasts and shows about healthy eating, Myra Goodman. Hello, Myra.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I love this series. I'm so honored to be a part of it.
It's just, we're thrilled to have you. And just in case someone listening doesn't know, how could you not? Myra and her husband are co-founders of Earthbound Farm, the largest grower of organic produce in North America and possibly the world. That would be my story, and I'm sticking to it. And Myra was a recent presenter at a TEDx talk in Manhattan, too, which I have listened to several times, and we'll send links out about that. And the author of three books, which we are going to talk about during the show. Myra, you are one very busy human being, and I'm telling you, you're an icon. It's really unbelievable.
Oh, Gina, thank you.
So I know I have it, you know, I have it segmented into things that we're going to talk about. I'd love you to give us a little bit of background about how you started Earthbound Farm, because it's romantic, because it was an 11-story apartment on East 86th Street, to a raspberry farm in Carmel Valley. So why don't we start with that and give a little bit of background about that and how you decided there was a conscious moment of why organic?
Well, I am a New York City girl. I was born in Brooklyn before Brooklyn was fashionable in the early 60s. And my husband was born in Buffalo, and we both ended up in Manhattan on East 86th Street. And I talk about my 11th floor apartment. I don't know how many stories the building was, but I grew up just looking out at the concrete building across the street, just so disconnected from where food was grown. My mom, it was from Hungary. She said she tried cooking her traditional meals for us once when we were kids, and we didn't eat it, and she never tried again. And we grew up on TV dinners and then food delivered to our door in Manhattan. And so when I had the opportunity to move on to this little raspberry farm in Carmel Valley after I graduated from UC Berkeley with my husband, Drew, who also grew up on East 86th Street, and we went to the same high school, but he was in 12th grade when I was in 9th grade, so we hardly knew each other, but we both came out to California for college, met out here, and moved on to this little 2.5-acre raspberry farm. And we got a crash course in how to farm the berries from the existing farmer. And he showed us how to spray all of the chemical dormant sprays and when the different herbicides were going to be applied and how to mix the chemical fertilizers and shoot them through the drip lines. And it was really a shock for me, because I never realized that so many chemicals were routinely used to grow our food. When you buy all your food in the supermarket, you don't see them or smell them or taste them. So until you're on the farm, you don't necessarily know about it, especially back over 30 years ago. It wasn't in the news, and people like you weren't doing shows about it. And so for me, standing in this beautiful Carmel Valley farm and the miracle of these trees that were growing these beautiful nuts and fruits and these vines full of delicious heirloom berries, the thought of putting these dangerous chemicals on this soil, on this food, applying it with my hands on food I was going to eat just seemed ridiculous. And Drew and I both felt that there had to be a way to farm in cooperation with nature, with respect for nature. And so from the very beginning, we became organic farmers.
And you talk about early adopters. I was eating that food. You're right. I was eating that chemical-laden pesticide, insecticide, and herbicide food because we aren't aware of it. And that's the really sad truth. So it was...
Oh, and I think in our culture, you know, for those of us who are... You know, we're born in the 50s and the 60s or even the 40s. You know, it was chemicals were going to improve our lives and make food healthier and make the world healthier and more convenient, and convenience meant happy, you know, and it really took a while for us to realize that these chemicals are really damaging to the environment and to wildlife and to the oceans and to our bodies.
I think about the workers. Oh my gosh, it's so gross that we're working when they're spraying, you know, DDT. I mean, it's just...
Right. Well, there's still, you've got workers out in those fields
and
they're handling these neurotoxins. And, you know, it's still an issue. And there's lots of studies that are showing a lot of health issues for farm workers and for the children of farm workers that are exposed in utero. So it's not DDT, but there are other really dangerous chemicals that are routinely applied.
I know that really dates me because I know that was outlawed. But it was, I mean, I remember watching the crop dusters come in and spray in places where I lived. I grew up in New Jersey, and despite what people think, it's not all Newark. It's there. New Jersey's a beautiful state. It's the Garden State, lots of farmland. And we used to watch the crop dusters, and God only knows.
Well, I know people would tell me that after the DDT was sprayed, they'd run into the fog of it so that they wouldn't have mosquitoes bite them for a long time.
Jeez, I mean, it's just, and those mosquitoes back east, they can be big ones. They can be zingers.
Yeah,
I sprayed off on my body
now
too. Yeah, we are.
That, you know, that there is more organic and there are people like you spreading the word. But you mentioned my TED talk, and one of the things that I talked about in my TEDx Manhattan talk is that only less than 1% of the farmland in the United States is organic. So that means about 99% is still using synthetic conventional chemicals to grow our food.
So and in that TEDx talk,
we've come a long way, and there's a long way to go.
I really want to talk a lot about that and devote a whole segment to it because it happened to really touch me. I don't think big is always bad, and you do the talk on In Praise of Big Organic. But before we go to that part, I didn't realize that you started with raspberries. I don't understand why, but I thought you started with organic lettuce. So the question fits both. How did you morph from the farmer that, you know, taught you how to put what spray on when to learning about how to do it to grow organically, your raspberries and your lettuce? What was the learning process and the learning curve?
Well, you know, back then, so it was 1984, there was no internet. And really, you know, there was the library and there were some books in the library. We had Rodale's Organic Gardening Encyclopedia. And then there was a nursery next door with one hippie guy that worked there that knew which soil amendments were organic, didn't have any chemicals, and which weren't. And he'd give us suggestions. And that was pretty much, you know, it was pretty much our resources, and we learned a lot by trial and error. And really the story of the, you know, Earthbound Farm is famous for our baby greens. We were the first company to successfully package salad for retail sale back in 1986. And we were able to do it without the very sophisticated technology that they needed for the chopped iceberg, which will turn brown so quickly, because it was whole baby greens. And that's really the story of how Earthbound grew from such a tiny little raspberry farm, these heirloom raspberries that we had to sell within 24 hours of picking them, to the transitioning so much ground and becoming the largest grower of organic produce in the country, was because we were the first with those specialty salads, and people were buying them because they were gourmet, because they were convenient, because they were beautiful, but not because they were organic initially, because initially there wasn't that much interest in organic.
And once you started to get bigger on the radar screen, and you know, when you talk about there wasn't any internet, it's like, oh my gosh, did we ever really live with or without it? Mrs. Green would not exist without it because it's my world of research. But it's like, press pause, everybody. There was a time, and look what these guys did without it. Did you get pushback from other farmers as you started to grow because you were going organic?
You know, when Drew and I started, people pretty much thought we were crazy. People thought being farmers was crazy, and growing organic was never going to work. No one had really shown that you could grow organic successfully on a large scale at that point. There were no really large organic farmers. And people also thought we were crazy to grow these baby greens and try and sell them in bags because there were no pre-washed salads on the shelf. That was the day when everybody ate Iceberg. And you saw these baby greens at Chez Panisse and a few really, really high-end restaurants, but most of the population had never glimpsed them. So we were ahead of our time, and you said when you introduced me that our story is sort of a romantic story, and I think part of the success of Earthbound was that Drew and I were a young, idealistic couple in love, and we both just thought it was the most brilliant idea because we noticed that when we had pre-washed our salad greens and put them in bags in our refrigerator, we would eat salad every night. And that when we had to go out and harvest, because at that point we were selling our baby greens in whole heads and bunches. So if we had to go out and harvest the lettuce and wash it and dry it, we would most of the night skip it. So we just felt that it could be a revolutionary product. And so even though it took years for it to really take off, I think because we both believed it and we had each other, it was sort of the two of us against the world, we were really able to persevere.
It is a great story. I mean, it is a great story. And I think being in the Carmel Valley, I mean, having it go to restaurants there where there are a number of amazing chefs and great restaurants, that was a good place to get it started. But you probably would have done fine if you started it in Alabama. So I'm not even going to comment.
I don't know. I think we were lucky. We had good soil, good climate, very close to the San Francisco Bay Area that was very progressive. So
right.
I think it was there was a lot of good fortune involved as well.
And I encourage people that didn't listen to the other show, the podcast is still up, because the funniest thing to me in talking with you on that entire show was, here you were going, plodding along, growing, expanding, and then Costco called. That was the day that changed Earthbound Farms' life forever.
Yeah, it was Costco, because we had a lot of really teeny customers at that point. And once Costco started selling our product and they were so successful at it, then all the other large retailers wanted to carry the same product as well.
A really
big
game changer.
So it was really that Costco was so progressive and interested in our product so early on. That was a huge part of our success.
Huge.
And that was 21 years ago.
That's unreal. I mean, I love that part of the story. It's the American dream, truly. So even though we're going to, in the third segment, I'd like to talk about, not just about your books, but about the evolution of Myra in the authoring of those books. God forbid some people don't listen to the whole hour of the show, and why would they not, right? I want to talk about your newest one, because it has really touched my life, my husband's life. It may sound melodramatic to say it changed our lives, but we're typical of two people who want to keep changing and move how we eat in a healthier direction. So Straight from the Earth is your newest cookbook. The little tab on it says irresistible vegan recipes for everyone. And up until we got the book, I mean, this is not my show, Myra, I know, but I'm like your infomercial because I love it so much.
Happy.
Well, and it's the truth. And I can tell you why it's so important for people to check out this book who are wanting to eat less meat, who are wanting to go more vegan and plant-based. Okay, the recipes are tasty. They're flavorful. It's not like eating cardboard, which some vegan recipes, like you're eating it and you're saying, okay, this is fake cheese. I'm not eating this. I don't, it still doesn't taste like cheese to me. And then the other thing, they're easy to do. They're not long prep time. And third is it's not full of these really weird, exotic ingredients that you have to go to four grocery stores to find. So I can authentically and legitimately say that you and your daughter, Maria, wrote what I hope will be a bestseller. I mean, for the health of the planet.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And you know, what's so interesting is that we really, I think very few people are going to be 100% vegan.
Right.
But we can all, as I was writing the book with my daughter, I really realized that our use of animal products in the kitchen, a lot of it is habitual. And also there's a lot of misconceptions. People think that to get enough protein, they need to eat animal flesh. And it's really not true. There's a lot of really healthy, much healthier plant-based proteins available. And so I just really thought that if the average eater had a collection of recipes that just happened to be vegan, they could start getting in the habit of cooking more plant-based meals. And what's really interesting now is that when I cook non-vegan food, like the other day I made a chicken curry, and I bought the same amount of chicken that I would have used in the past to make a chicken curry. And then I realized that I could use a third of it
right. And
freeze the rest of it and put in a lot of garbanzo beans and a lot of potatoes and carrots and peas and use a small percentage of chicken and have this amazing flavorful curry that was even healthier and even more tasty and even more colorful. So it's kind of seeped into my cooking even when I'm not cooking vegan recipes.
And you don't need to eat as much meat. When I think about the servings they still serve you in restaurants and people get a steak and it's like a 10-ounce steak, even that, and there are bigger ones. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. That should last you a week, dude. Shouldn't be eating that much meat. But I don't say anything. I just smile and say, I hope you enjoy your meal. Okay.
Right, and that you don't do it too often. I was looking at the Meatless Monday website.
Uh-huh.
And they talk about the benefits to the planet of reducing our meat consumption. And it said that on average, 40 calories of fossil fuel energy go into every calorie of feedlot beef in the United States, while only 2.2 calories are needed to create plant-based protein.
I mean, and how hard is it to do Meatless Mondays? I mean, we always do Meatless Mondays now, and it can make a huge difference. And in case you're wondering,
thank you. I'm so glad you like my book, Gina. That means so much to me.
And there have been pictures up on Instagram of the pea soup. Thank you, Mr. Green, for cooking these wonderful things. But, you know, you look at things, there's like crostini and vine-ripe tomatoes with a white bean puree. I could go on and on, but we'll talk about the cookbooks a little more in the third segment. Also good for people that are celiac or gluten intolerant because it's fresh, delicious, organic, healthy foods. And one of the people on my team that I gave her this, I ordered it for my team, and she got close to tears the very night she put something up on Instagram of one of the recipes she was trying. And I mean, she's only 20 years old and she can't eat any, she's celiac, not gluten intolerant. So she has to be careful. And she said, this has been such a gift. So there's my commercial for Myra and Maria's book,
Straight from the Earth. And we'll let your listeners know I didn't hire you for that.
You did not hire me for this. And I said to you, I said, please, can I talk about Straight from the Earth? Because I want people to buy it. And when we come back, this is always kills me. I'm getting the 2-minute warning for the first break. But one of the reasons I want to talk about your TEDx talk in Manhattan is because I think we need to really explode the myth. And I'm doing everything I can that big is bad. Because to me, if we don't have the game changers like Earthbound Farm, who is selling to places like Whole Foods and Costco, the needle isn't going to move forward. Your statistic, 1% of the food we eat is organic.
1%, less than 1% of the farmland. In terms of sales, 4.2% of food sales are organic in this country. But in terms of volume, they really haven't been able to calculate it. They just calculate it by dollars. And since organic food costs more, it's way less than 4.2% in volume.
And in dollars, I think I saw in the TED Talk, it's $30 billion versus $740 billion in terms of the industry. So we can talk about that.
Yes, and one of the things that I say on the TED Talk is that all organic food sales in this country are less than half of one company's sales. They're half of PepsiCo sales.
You know, it really blows me away. And what I love about the TED Talk, too, I think I need to be your agent now, is you did it in praise of Big Organic. It was done, you know, talking about the misconceptions, debunking the myths. And when we come back, everybody, stay here with me because you want to hear from Myra Goodman, co-founder with her husband, Drew, of the Earthbound Farm, about why it is a myth. And in praise of Big Organic. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back. Hi there. This is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine. It's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines. It gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit ChapmanTucson.com.
Bookman Sports Exchange is now open at 3330 East Speedway. We're taking our passion and experience of buying, selling, and trading books and music and applying it to the world of sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear. We are giving you another way to save money on the things that you love, Bookman style. Remember, Bookman Sports Exchange, sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear, now open daily from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Speedway east of Country Club. Check out bookmans.com for more info.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And hopefully this show is getting you excited to think about eating healthier, eating organic, and buying the book Straight from the Earth. Now it's making me laugh, okay? So our guest for the fourth series in this series of What Am I Eating and Why Should I Care is Myra Goodman. She is the co-founder with her husband Drew of Earthbound Farm. They are the largest grower of organic produce in North America and possibly the world. She was a recent presenter at a TEDx talk in Manhattan and the author of three books about food: Food to Live By, the Earthbound Farm Organic Cookbook, Earthbound Cook, and most recently Straight from the Earth. So let's talk about the TED Talk in praise of Big Organic. What made you pick that as the topic? Because there are a myriad of things you could have talked about. Why did you decide this is the one I'm going to take on, or did TEDx pick it for you?
No. I picked it, and it's really it's a message that I have wanted to get across for a long time, because I've just seen ads. I think it started with Omnivore's Dilemma, Michael Pollan's book.
Right. Oh.
And I think that he exposed so many of the problems of the industrial food system, especially relating to how animals are raised and our dependence on corn and soybeans in this country and monocropping and all the problems of how farming has developed, industrial conventional farming has developed. And then he kind of takes these large organic farms and he says, you know, it's an illusion that these are perfect organic farms. You want the small regional farm. He doesn't even say the small regional organic farm. And we started having a lot of kind of big is bad sentiment against Earthbound from the early adopters, from the people that were the first to choose organic, not as much the mainstream population.
Right.
And a lot of misconceptions were spreading by even a lot of the kind of renowned academics in the field. And one of the things that I was hearing is that large organic farms aren't much better than conventional farms because they just practice input substitution. They just substitute organic material materials for conventional ones, and it's really not such a healthy farming system. And it's just not true. So one of the, what I did in the TED Talk is I talked about four misconceptions, and one is that large organic farms are industrial, because it is not possible to grow organic food industrially. You can't monocrop organic farms. You have to practice crop rotation. You have to plant beneficial habitats for insects. There are no organic fumigants to kill diseases. There are no organic herbicides to kill weeds. And so when you're farming organically, on any scale, you're avoiding all of these chemicals, you're building healthy soil, you're creating a healthy environment for farm workers and surrounding wildlife, and you're growing the healthiest food possible for the people that are eating your harvest. So I say the benefits of organic farming are reaped acre by acre. Small farms, large farms, they're all contributing to a healthier world.
And you said, one of the quotes I wrote down is that nature has rules that can't be broken. That was golden. That was like, that is so true. So you can't, I love that old commercial, even though it was about something. It's not nice to fool with Mother Nature. And you.
Right, right. Oh, what was that?
I don't know, but it was not for something healthy.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, I wanted to be honest and say, you know, one of the things that I'm actually most proud of is that a lot of the growers for Earthbound Farm are conventional growers that transitioned some of their ground, some of them all of their ground eventually to organic. And at first they did try and cut corners in terms of organic farming techniques to make organic more profitable. There's a reason why organic food costs more. It's more expensive to farm organically. There's more crop loss. And one example is that you have to take some of your land and you have to plant beneficial habitat. So you're planting crops that you're never going to harvest and make money off of. And those crops serve two purposes. They're a home for your beneficial insects. So we control our pests with beneficial insects that eat those pests and off the crops. That's how they live, and they need a place to live when you till that crop. And they also serve as a distraction crop for pests. So we have to devote a certain percentage of our farmland to those beneficial habitats. And so we had growers trying to reduce the amount of their acreage planted because it would be more profitable if they reduced it. And then they found it didn't work. They had too much crop loss. They had to have those beneficial insect habitats. So that's over time, because we've been farming organically now. This is our 30th anniversary. We saw that you can't break nature's rules when it comes to organic farming. It's the same rules when you're a large farm or a small farm, and that most of these organic farming techniques are really scale neutral.
And what does that mean, scale neutral?
Scale neutral means they work on small farms and large farms alike. That large farms have to do the same practices as small organic farms in terms of rotating your crops, building the health of your soil, weeding by hand instead of, you know, and by tractor instead of using herbicides. That when we were a 2-acre farm in Carmel Valley, we had to do those same things to be successful. And now Earthbound Farm has over 200 growers on more than 45,000 crop acres, and they have to use those same organic farming principles to be successful long term.
So when you use that example, 200 farms and that many acres, just for what you control alone, how much does it help to avoid the use of chemicals, not just being put into the earth, but affecting the wildlife, affecting the growers? How is there a number?
Well, we calculated, what I said in my TED Talk, for 2013, it was more than 19 million pounds of synthetic agricultural chemicals. And, you know, I wanted to make that tangible for people. And so I looked up what the populations were of America's largest cities, and it kind of blew me away because I realized that these 19 million pounds are more than the population than every man, woman, and child in America's five biggest cities. So if you think of everyone living in New York, everyone in LA, Chicago, Houston, and Philadelphia, that we, Earthbound Farm, one company that's relatively small compared to the size of these food companies in this country, we avoid more pounds of agricultural chemicals than all those people combined every year.
And another one that like that's mind blowing, and I think people like to get their head around numbers. What does this really translate to? Another one that you did in this misconception about, you know, large organic farmers farms are industrial. Do people really denigrate the use of high tech agricultural equipment? Like, who does that?
They really do. And some of the people that are the most knowledgeable in the food industry, and what they, you know, when we talked about it, they were saying that, you know, well, it uses so much fossil fuel to use these big tractors. And I said, but, you know, small farms use small tractors. You know, it's the amount
scale.
Of per acre,
right.
is it really any different in a small farm or a large farm? And that if you didn't use these tractors, if it was all hand labor, this food would be so prohibitively expensive that nobody could afford it.
And it's hard enough as it is. I mean, it is still more expensive. I believe that's a mindset that people who say it is might buy a $4 or $5 Starbucks a day. And if they put it into their organic produce, it would be, you know, talk about net zero. I mean, no impact on the budget whatsoever. So anyway, but I find it hard to believe that people would actually criticize you for using high tech equipment. It's like, are they scared? Are they big dogs?
I think there's that fantasy of the small farm and,
right.
You know, it's done by hand and it's this closed ecological loop. And there is, you know, that perfect little farm, but that farm isn't going to be able to produce enough food to feed many more people than live on that farm.
And what you also said in the TED Talk, so you can tell that I did my homework, is that small farms aren't always more ecologically sustainable. It's not true. I mean, when you talk about scale, they have to adhere to the same practices to get their organic certification, regardless of size. Is that a true statement?
Well, you know what it is that a lot of people, and some of my close friends that are very, very educated, they believe that local small farms are organic. They just believe that. And I think so many people promote, you know, buy local, that local equals ecological. So people assume that these small farmers don't use chemicals. And so what I talked about in the TEDx talk was that most small farms are conventional farms, and they
right.
rely on virtually the same arsenal of toxic and persistent chemicals as the large conventional farms, and that locally applied chemicals are never good for locals. We don't want those chemicals sprayed near where we're working and where we're jogging and where our kids are going to school and where our water source comes from. And so that's why, like I said, in Praise a Big Organic, because I really wanted to come out and just, you know, hit the bullseye with what I wanted to talk about. But I really wanted my talk to be unifying. And I want to, you know, I really emphasize that every organic farm, from the smallest farmer to the largest farmer, we're all helping to improve the health of our food supply, the health of our environment, that it's really about supporting organic farms of every size and try and explain to people why big isn't bad, why big is good, why big makes big impacts.
So when you're talking about the morphing, like you encourage in the talk to have more and more local farmers start to adapt organic methods, I think I live in La La Land because the people that I'm surrounded with at this point, probably because I'm Mrs. Green, all of us are eating healthier. Know your farmer. When you go to the farmer's market, don't just assume because you're buying from a local farmer that it's not bought in Mexico and brought over the border. You have to do your homework and ask the questions. But in terms of going from a regular farm to a non-organic to an organic, how do you start? And who, you know, I would think it's so trending upward that everybody would want to get on board. Your numbers don't necessarily.
Well, so this is the thing. So to transition your land from conventional to organic, it's a 3-year transition period.
Wow.
And that's really to protect the consumer.
Right.
So that you can't be spraying toxic chemicals and then say, okay, now I'm organic, you know, and you're planting seeds in the soil that still has all those chemical residues. So, and it really does take, we've really found it really does take at least 3 years to start to build the health of the soil, to replace the organic matter, to have it be a soil that's healthy enough to support thriving organic plants. And so that is a huge economic sacrifice and burden for the farmer, because that's 3 years where they're either not selling a crop, they're just growing cover crops which are meant to enrich the soil, getting it ready to be organic, or they're using organic methods, but they have to sell their produce at conventional prices. And so you pretty much always are losing money on those acres that you're transitioning. And so that's why I feel that it really comes down to consumer demand. It comes down to consumers being willing to pay more for organic because it costs more for the farmer. There's the transition. And then the actual organic farming, it's more expensive and there's more crop loss. And so it's really about consumer demand. And it's incredible because I really call organic a consumer revolution, because these big food companies, they weren't going out saying, hey, organic is healthier, you don't want food that's grown with chemicals. Organic has been an inconvenience that a lot of these food companies have taken on, and a lot of the big supermarkets have taken on, because they don't want to lose their consumers. And so it's really come from consumers saying, we want healthy food and we're willing to pay more for it.
Yeah, a lot of them moms. So women, wake up. I mean, it's like, vote with your fork. That's all you have to do. It's not about legislation, which would help, but there's ways to vote, and with your fork and your purse is the best way. Let's talk about the fourth misconception that you addressed, because to me it was like, when I was watching, I said, this is so Myra. When organic gets big, it loses its soul, and you have to tell us about Otto. This is like the human interest part of the big lie.
Well, it's very interesting, because a lot of people say, well, these big organic farms, they don't have the ethos of the small organic pioneers that were so committed to, you know, to the earth and to these more holistic values. And so what I shared is that it's very interesting for us at Earthbound, because most of our growers, our large growers, were conventional growers, and they came into organic because of the economic opportunity. They didn't come in because of this deep, heartfelt commitment to organic. They said, oh, okay, you know, my iceberg lettuce, it's hard to make a living off it right now. Conventional iceberg, it looks like this organic thing has a lot of potential. So Otto is this wonderful example. Earthbound Farm hired Otto almost 20 years ago when his two children were still young. And he had been a conventional farmer his whole life. And he took on this organic job because it had a good salary. And he thought the company that he was going to work for, you know, had success in its future. It wasn't about any heartfelt commitment. And then he spent his first day walking around the organic fields. And he came home. And his little children, whenever he came home, he has a little son and daughter, you know, they were adorable back then, and they would rush up to hug their daddy when he walked in the door. And always when he was a conventional farmer, he would frantically push them away because he had been walking in fields where pesticides were sprayed, and he was terrified that there were pesticides on his pants that would be bad for him if they clung to his pant leg and put their faces on his jeans. And he realized when he walked in from working in the organic field, his kids could run up and grab him, and he could pick them up and hug them, and he didn't have to go take off his clothes and take a shower before he could hug his kids. And right then he fell in love with organic farming, and he is one of the most passionate organic farmers I know. So I really believe that when you give these conventional farmers and these conventional food businessmen exposure to organic, and they for themselves start seeing the benefit, they have their aha moment. So it's like, to me, it's not an exclusive club that we only want to let certain people into. We don't want organic to be an exclusive club. And I say that in the TEDx talk. We want as many farmers embracing organic, as many retailers selling organic. And we want as many small growers transitioning to organic and little small farms sprouting up in our neighborhoods. We want an organic revolution everywhere we can get it.
And, you know, I think about things when I was watching the talk about You know, talk about Zappos. Everybody, it's one of the best companies in the world to work for. So's Google. People want to work there. They created massive, huge corporate cultures that still have fun and soul. So if you think bigger is bad, get over yourself. That's how I feel. It's like,
it's at the heart of it. You don't want to make blanket statements. There are big companies
that are terrible.
That do bad things, and that all the metrics that they work towards are financial gain,
money,
and they don't really care about the quality of what they're producing or its impact on the environment. And then there are incredible companies that care a lot about their worker health and a lot about their environmental impact and the quality of their products. And so same with small companies. You can have small companies that are paying their employees minimum wage and not giving them health insurance and not giving them paid time off and not using sustainable practices, and then there's small companies that are working towards really high ideals. And so it's about breaking away from those misconceptions and really doing your research, like you said.
And it doesn't take a lot. I mean, it really doesn't take a lot, especially with the internet, even before you go shopping. So the call to action for this segment is choose organic, do your homework, even if it costs a little more. Your health and the health of your family and the planet is worth it. So we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Myra's books and some of more philosophical questions about where she thinks the soul industry is going. So please stay here with me and hear more from Myra Goodman.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative. Our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
The Habit Store is a big operation with staff and volunteers working hard to reduce our carbon footprint. We sell donated building materials, furniture and appliances, and recycle the metal from items that we can't repair or sell. We even have solar panels on the roof. The good deals we offer shoppers means Tucson Habitat can build and renovate homes for hardworking people. The Habit Store's store hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturdays, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road, just east of I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I know you are certainly getting the opportunity to think about a lot today because of our great guest, Myra Goodman. She's co-founder with her husband, Drew, of Earthbound Farm, the largest grower of organic produce in North America and possibly the world. A recent presenter at a TEDx talk in Manhattan called In Praise of Big Organic, and the author of 3 books about food. And Myra, the reason, first of all, thank you again for taking the time to be joining me again for this important series on what am I eating and why should I care. But
I just love that you do this series, and I want to be on your show whenever you'll have me.
Well, that's really going to be, you'll be really surprised because we have fun. And, you know, I'm just going to tell a little story. I had lunch today with this wonderful woman from the University of Arizona, and she listened to my shows. And sometimes I think I sound a little bit overly enthusiastic and, you know, blah, 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 very harsh critic of myself. And the first thing she started with is, I love your enthusiasm. It's just not like listening to every other talk show. And it's like, it's you. So it was, what a way to come into this show, because it's very easy for me to be me with Myra Goodman.
Well, I love you. So it's so great to get to talk with you, and it's so nice to share your enthusiasm and inspiration with your listeners on such an important topic that's really been my life's work.
And it's so fun when I'm interviewing other guests. I emailed you about Amy Valpone, anybody that we're talking about, and she goes, and she'll say, well, and I went out to Earthbound Farm and I met Myra Goodman and her husband Drew, and then there's like, we ring the bells, we have a kumbaya love song about Myra. It's pretty fun. It really is. If people are into laughter, it's great.
That. Thank you.
So the reason I wanted to talk about each one of the books, and we don't have to go into detail about them, but what I love that you covered on the last show that you did with me is, first you wrote Foods to Live By, I believe, the Earthbound Farm Organic Cookbook, then Earthbound Cook, and most recently Straight from the Earth, which you wrote with your daughter Maria. And it was, you said it was kind of not consciously necessarily, but really reflective of your journey to a more plant-based, not anti-meat but less meat diet. Is that accurate to talk about it in that way?
Well, you know what it was? So my first cookbook, Food to Live By, I really shared my passion for organic farming and my passion for cooking and cooking the harvest and how that inspired me, because I really learned, I told you how I grew up on TV dinners and Chinese food delivered to the door. I really learned how to cook on the farm, not wanting to waste the harvest. And I realized that for so long, organic was really the only way I was ecologically conscious in my kitchen. And that there were so many ways to green your kitchen. And so my second cookbook, The Earthbound Cook, was really about how your food choices and your preparation habits can make such a huge impact on the environment and on your personal health. And what happened when I wrote The Earthbound Cook is we had this wonderful guy working at Earthbound Farm named Chad Smith, and he was a Stanford MBA, and we had hired him to green our supply chain. And I was lucky enough to have him help me with a lot of the eco research for that cookbook. And while we were working on the book, he became a vegan because we learned that eating lower on the food chain was really one of the most important things that you can do to reduce your carbon footprint, to reduce your use of water. You know, so many of the things that we really need to take care of, so many resources that are really dwindling in this country and in the world. And, he just said he realized that he was a little bit hypocritical eating so much meat and saying he was an environmentalist. So he said, if you want me to help you on your next book, it has to be vegan. And I said, Chad, I need to eat meat to be full and to feel good, and I am never writing a vegan cookbook. I'm sorry to tell you. And then what happened was, over time, I started realizing how many things I absolutely love just happened to be vegan. And then my daughter was at UC Berkeley and lived in a vegetarian co-op. And for her work shift, she signed up to cook dinner for 60 people every Sunday, and the meals had to be vegan because a lot of the people that lived were vegan. And so she was all year long making up incredible multi-course vegan meals that were making my mouth water. And I said, honey, when you graduate, you're going to need a job, and how about the two of us collaborate on a vegan cookbook geared towards omnivores, vegan food for everyone, for vegans, for vegetarians, for omnivores, and we can really try and spread the word on how delicious and easy it can be to eat more plant-based foods.
And there it was. So it's also funny, this is one of my whirling dervish moments, because the Straight from the Earth cookbook, there's another thing that I forgot to mention that I love about it. You cannot really talk about this book fairly without talking about Sarah Remington. The pictures, the photographs in it are award-winning, and it's hard to photograph food. Anybody that I know that photographs food says it's the hardest thing in the world to really capture and have it look healthy and not look fake and all this stuff. So we have to do a hats off to her. And then the other part is, I don't know where I read this, Myra, but you're the long-haired beauty, and your daughter is the short hair.
Well, you know, I was trying to explain how our styles are so different. And I really think collaborating with my daughter, she's now 24. She's an apprentice midwife living in Oakland.
Oh, my gosh.
She was 22 and 23 when we worked on the book. How it yielded a much more creative and diverse selection of recipes than it would have with me creating them on my own. And so Mireille is just very unconventional. And so my example was that I have always had long hair. And it might, you know, when it's short, it's shoulder length. And when it's long, it's mid-back. But I've always had long, dark hair. I've never changed my style. I've never changed my color. And my daughter had long hair growing up, and when she went to Berkeley, she wanted to see what it was like. She actually, it was like she was curious to see how people reacted to her. And what she did is she shaved her head into a mohawk, and then she shaved her head so it was bald, and then she let it grow out so it's just kind of a short hairdo. And she's very unconventional, and she's brave, and she's willing to shake it up. And so, you know, there's certain recipes. One of our most popular recipes, we call it our eccentric Caesar salad, and Mireille made this delicious vegan Caesar salad, and she put some curry powder in the dressing. And I was like, honey, we can't, Caesar is a classic recipe. It has a taste profile people expect. We can't put curry in a Caesar dressing. But when you taste her salad, it's fabulous. And so we realized that I would feel comfortable if we gave it an adjective to qualify it. So we call it an eccentric Caesar. And it's one of the best recipes in the book. And I would never have played around with a Caesar recipe
no
like
kidding.
That.
No kidding. And please tell her.
That recipe if you haven't tried that yet.
Please tell her that I had my daughter Emily, who's 25, at home, so I was an early adopter too, okay? I had a midwife. back then my father was, I remember him saying, thank God she's not going to have any more children. This is killing me. He was in the back bedroom somewhere with a pillow over his head humming because he just didn't want his daughter to have a baby at home. So let's get back to the book Straight from the Earth because I digress. So in the book, this is what I would like to tell people. There's salad dressings. There's breakfast ideas. There's smoothies. You know, you talk about spring rolls, there's biscuits, there's polenta. Do you have your top five faves that you could pick out, Myra?
In the book?
Yeah,
well,
you can't do it. You can't.
The recipe I make the most are my brownies, my very chocolatey chocolate brownies, because my husband, they're his favorite thing in the world. He thinks that they're better than any brownie out there. And my cookbook, so Straight from the Earth, is all whole grain, so I don't use white flour in any recipe. So these brownies, instead of eggs, we use ground chia seeds that are mixed with coffee instead of water. That's our egg substitute. And we use coconut oil instead of butter, and we use the whole wheat pastry flour, so and walnuts. So we are considering it a health food, and they're fabulous. So I make those all the time. Another recipe that we make all the time, we have a great baked falafel recipe. And so I love Greek food, so we make the falafels. And because we couldn't use yogurt for the sauce, Mireille invented this wonderful sauce that's made with blended raw cashews, which is so delicious. And we serve it with a little Greek salad. And I love that. I make that all the time. I make the polenta all the time with the spicy heirloom sauce. And that Caesar recipe is really popular. There's also a cabbage and carrot crunch salad that I make a lot. And what I love about that is that that's a great recipe to make in the winter when there's not much summer produce available, because it's red cabbage, it's carrots, it's romaine lettuce, and apples, which is available all year round, and it has the crunch of toasted almonds. So that's a delicious salad that brings this beautiful color to your kitchen any time of year.
And I wish people would put their recipes up on Instagram. We actually have an Instagram contest going on because we always want to grow our numbers, because to us that translates to growing our impact and our reach. It's not because we want another like, it's because another people likes the work we're doing. And I think it's very different. So if you get this cookbook and you do a recipe, post it on Instagram. I love Instagram. I'm a 63-year-old mad woman about Instagram. It's so easy.
I just joined two weeks ago. My son was home on spring break with his girlfriend, and they were looking at the Earthbound Farm Throwback Thursday photos. I'd never even been on Instagram. A lot of them were me. It was one of Maria, my daughter, my co-author, in a little bib eating salad greens in a high chair. And so I had my son's girlfriend, Kira, set me up on Instagram. So I will go and start following you. And I'm just getting to know Instagram.
I'm not an early adopter, but I'm going to catch up. I just love it because to me, it's so simple. You take a picture, and it's funny because when I eat out, I'm eating things like sweet potato tacos, which I never saw in my future. And what happens is I'm so excited to take a bite, and then I say, oh my gosh, I forgot to take a picture. So I fix the plate back up. Everybody at the table is cracking up, and I'm saying, no, I have to Instagram this. And I smooth over the hummus, because you really don't want to have the half-eaten Instagram picture out there if you're trying to, you know, send this beautiful message about the food you're eating. But I think you'll love it. Welcome to Instagram.
Okay. I am, as soon as we get off the interview, I am going to go and start following you.
Yeah, it's really, to me, it is, I like it so much more than Facebook. So let's ask you a couple of, and people, you can get the cookbook at Amazon.com. It's very easy. There are some wonderful reviews, one of which is mine, which I wrote
Thank
one night.
Thank you.
And it was like, why don't you put the word out? I did a review of about 3 books that night, and it really matters to share on Amazon what you think, because other people are not, they don't care what you, Myra Goodman, the author, are saying. They care about what me, Gina Murphy Darling, is reading and saying about it. So I think it's important that people just take 5 minutes and review it. Okay, let's go philosophical a little bit. You've been doing this for over 30 years. How are you feeling? You talk about questions of the soul. Are we trending in the more healthy direction fast enough for people's health and for the preservation of the planet? Because everything you said is as connected to our health as it is to the health of the planet. People are record number of every kind of disease that you can think of, you know, diabetes, obesity, just new report on autism. I mean, the beat goes on. Record numbers, pancreatic cancer. So what do you, Myra Goodman, see in your world in terms of how are we trending?
Right. You know what? It's so hard because where I am, where I live on the original farm in Carmel Valley,
right,
it's so different from a lot of parts of this country.
It is.
And so I think that it's really interesting. If you ask people in Northern California what percentage of food is organic, they're going to guess 20% because that's what they're seeing all
right
around them.
Right.
And if you go to some little town in the South, you might not find anything that's organic. And you're going to see all those rates of obesity and heart disease and diabetes are going to be so much higher. But I do think that finally people are starting to understand the connection between diet and health, and they're starting to understand that when they improve their diet, they improve their health, that it's a good investment. But there's so many people that have never really been taught how to cook. We have this culture. I just think about my mom and the TV dinners where cooking is considered an inconvenience, not a joy. And that eating, you know, getting some fast food through a drive-through is a great way to take care of dinner so you have more time to hang out and watch TV or play video games or sit at your computer. So we have a culture that's much more sedentary. And I think that we're making inroads, but we have a long way to go, and our culture is challenging.
And for my Kickstarter, one of the things I said in the video is, we're taking on big bucks. We're taking on agribusiness. We're taking on major advertisers. Every other commercial you see is about why you should eat a Reese's peanut butter cup. And unfortunately for me, that's one of my favorite things to eat, and I won't buy them because I'm boycotting just about everything in the chocolate industry, especially if it's got Hershey's name on it. But it's right. your senses are assaulted with eat this cheap, crappy food. I'm so glad Subway got outed for what's in their food. It's like,
yes. The environmental working group really, really helped with that. And then, you know, if you look at Chipotle,
love to look at Chipotle.
Have you seen their series, the video series that they have online?
And I interviewed Chris Arnold on my show, and he really, I mean, there's another, when you talk about some fast food place that can move the needle forward, Chipotle is where we go to eat.
Yes, exactly. And I think, okay, so I think that what we need to do is we need to look at these inspiring examples like Chipotle. And what I love about Chipotle is that when I go to my local Chipotle in Monterey and I'm online, you see people of every income bracket, you know, of every profession. You've got me, Miss Organic Farmer, happy to eat there. And you've got, you know, the kid that works at the Foot Locker.
That can build their own burrito.
There's over that really probably doesn't know much about health and nutrition.
Right.
And they're eating there because it tastes good and it's affordable and it's fast. So I think the more options we have like that, where we show a model like that that's really viable, you know, that gives me hope. And that goes back to what we were talking about, the big versus small. When you have a chain like that, that's as big as they are with the buying power they have, you make a big impact.
And it really just helps your family so much. I mean, it's really great to have a fast food option. So everybody, we are having to, you know, it's like, now it's time to say goodbye. And I can't believe I pulled that out of my head.
Great to talk with you.
And I want to share with you that for the fifth of our 8-part series, you are going to love this, Myra. What am I eating and why should I care? It all starts with your fork. Is Dawn Underaga from Environmental Working Group talking about good food on a tight budget? She and her research team have proven that it can be done. So it's a perfect follow-up to your show and everything you said. Thank you, my friend. Everybody make it a great green week, and thank you for being a part of Mrs. Green's World.